Do we need to cut the bit where you admitted that you didn't smoke and didn't drink much wine? Like, won't they revoke your passport for that?
That's the thing I worried about for many years. And then, crazily enough, Americans taught me how to drink coffee and made me enjoy wine more. Because people are like, this is expensive. We should not waste it. Whereas in France, it's like, whatever. Just pour. I'll have whatever. They're all pretty good. So it's easier.
Hi, Olivier.
Hi, Derek. Hi, Sean.
We're joined by Olivier Lacan. Is that how you say
Perfect.
Your last name?
You got
yeah,
it.
Yeah, look at that.
Bravo.
This absolute jerk who had the gall to give a talk at the same time as Tess.
I'm so sorry.
I personally blame you for this.
But I told her I would defend her against your puns. And I couldn't, obviously, because I was talking at the same time. So that's my excuse. I was just too busy to defend her from your Twitter puns.
So you're a frequent, you come up on our podcast often because we talk about changelogs.
Okay, good.
Often.
I thought it was for other nefarious
reasons. Okay. No. So you are the creator, maintainer, creative genius behind keepachangelog.org?
Com.
Keepachangelog.com.
Yeah, we're serious.
It's not a...
It's a commercial enterprise. I'm making so much money. Two of those three things that you said were right. The genius part, not so much, because I just stole, well... It is kind of genius to steal good ideas, I guess. Yeah. But it actually comes out of open source frustrations and also good practices that I just like noticed. And I was like, well, this is so obviously better than this other project. Or I was working on an internal thing at Envy Labs, Code School, and Nate Bibler was working on a little open source tool for status check reporting for HAProxy. It's a little gem that you drop in that just reports a status.json endpoint. So HAProxy can be like, oh, you're alive. Mm-hmm. It was internal. It wasn't even out yet. It wasn't like he waited until the release to be like, we're going to make a changelog and we're going to make a readme. Just for first few iterations, he started building his changelog and putting links to diffs in the changelog and like having little like markdown headers. And it was beautiful. Dates, everything was organized. And it was so obvious to see that it was building up. Like the project was getting more mature through the changelog. So I got addicted to it. So Nate's to blame mostly. And a lot of other good change logs that I saw. Yeah.
But I think like with most things, there was a good idea.
Yeah.
And you ran with it.
That's true.
So you get the credit. Congratulations.
Just screamed with it.
I like it. It's an easy format to follow. And in particular, like every single pull request ever on Rails that sits around for more than about 5 minutes without getting merged will have a merge conflict in the change log because it's every new change gets added to the top of that file no matter what. And even, it, like just the act of having it broken into different
subsets
like helps so much with that and also makes it much easier to read because generally, I do care about the new features that were added before I care about bug fixes. I do have a thought for you, though. I think I may have brought this up with you on Twitter. Mm-hmm. But one of the recommended headings is deprecations.
Yes.
But deprecations are by definition because you are changing something or removing something.
Yes.
And so it feels very strange to, especially if you're doing a lot of deprecations because you're doing a major change to your API, it feels weird to just dump all of that in this one bucket and you kind of lose the bucketing. But then it also feels weird to have it under the header changed when... Mm-hmm. You haven't actually made the change.
Yet.
You have deprecated.
You've signaled
it.
Your intent.
Yes.
And then every time a new major version is released, the change log is removed.
Yep.
Removed all deprecated items.
Yep. Well, actually, that seems tedious. And I think part of the tedium of having the headers or repeating things that you might have said in a previous release or something like that, that idea is basically exactly the same as empty folders in Rails. Like, there's an empty bucket there. That doesn't really answer your question, but first of all, the empty bucket is a good habit to have because you start thinking, huh, do I have anything to deprecate? Do I have anything that actually changed? Do I have anything that I removed? But for the deprecation, the header almost doesn't matter. The fact that there are headers there to remind you to think and check. Oh, okay. And yes, the implementation in real life, it's kind of like Semver.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say, because it depends on if you're following Semver or not. Because like Rails could benefit from having a separate deprecations header, whereas like since Diesel actually follows Semver, there is never going to be an item in changed that isn't actually a deprecation. There will never be an item in removed that isn't just a deprecation, unless it says removed all deprecated items.
Yeah, the patterns that I saw in a lot of repos were the people would put in brackets, they would say deprecated, in front of a change or deprecation or security. They put a little tag basically in the line in the change log. They would just surround a big screaming security fixes. Yeah. And I saw that enough that that works too. You can do that. The problem with that is that it's last thought. You group things under these are changes, not what kind of changes, doesn't matter. And as you said, a lot of people who glance through the change log look for features mostly. Mm-hmm. And if they had a bug that they were affected by, they look for the bug fixes and like, oh, is that the bug fix? So the buckets almost also they help you write your releases.
Yeah.
So for Rails, like, it's tedious to summarize all of the things that changed and were notable changes or additions or fixes that you might have run into. And you're like, oh, this version came out. I bet they fixed my, oh, yes, they fixed that thing because it's right there in the fixes or in the changed section. Mm-hmm. I think the headers, yeah, they're just like Semvert. The guidelines will break down when confronted with reality if you don't follow Semvert or if you do, but like in a different way.
Right.
I think it's cool. It's fine. That, you know, you can adapt it as long as you think not individual sets of changes that are not categorized, because often you see the same words in entries. You see an entry in the changelog that says changed X, updated, you know, Z, and then they just, it's the same thing. You're saying the same thing over and again. Just group these things.
Right.
And, it, and if you find a different heading that makes more sense to your project because you have, say, deprecations are normal changes, you could even state it and say, like,
yeah, we have at the very top, A, linking to your lovely website saying this is the format that we follow, and then I say this project follows Semver as defined in link to Rust RFC. That defines exactly what Semver means for Rust libraries and what is... Because Rust, like, we basically made the observation that there are a lot of things that are technically breaking changes, but if we make those require Semver major updates... It basically makes Semver meaningless because everything has to be a major update.
Yeah.
And so there are a bunch of changes that you are allowed to make. So, for example, if Rust were to follow Semver as explicitly to the letter as possible, adding a public function is a major breaking change because you could import things, right? And so you could do use diesel colon colon star, use all of the public items in diesel, and then they could use other library colon colon star. And if the new function that I added happened to have the same name as a function there, now you've imported two functions with the same name, your code stops compiling. So we've basically anywhere where it's like the thing that could be breaking is a naming collision, and there is a forwards compatible way to, if you could have written your code.
It's a gentle breaking change.
Yeah, minor breaking change is what we call it. Anyway, but so yeah, at the top we link, we follow this exact definition of Semver, and I hope more Rust libraries do that.
You gave me a thought, I don't know if Derek, you wanted to bounce off of that, but.
No, go ahead.
You gave me a thought that I didn't intend for Keep a Changelog to support Semver. It was more like, well, Semver's there, a lot of people use it, some people hate it. Many, the people who hate it a lot.
Yeah.
And
shout out to David.
Yeah. If you do hate it, you'll hate it less if there's a changelog that's really well maintained.
Yeah.
Because if someone's following Semver in a weird way or in a way that's super orthodox, how do you say that?
Orthogonal?
Orthodoxy, like following the rules dogmatically without like, no, it's just, we're going to do exactly what Olivier said that one time, even though he changed his mind like 15 times since then. even though it's not really my opinion, it's more like other people kind of agreed, oh, this sort of makes sense, but you found that one use case. I feel like if it's explained in a change log by example, like you see five releases and every release has a deprecation section, and you see why, because you see the items that are deprecated. You're like, oh, that makes sense. I know what to expect from this library and not just like Semver, which is, did you interpret it the way that I think you did?
I've never really paid much attention to what the, like, I know like fixes should be one and changes should be another one and deprecations maybe should be, but like, if I decide I want a new header in my changelog, I'm just going to put a new header in my changelog.
I've got a new header in the most recent release of Diesel. I've got a jokes header.
Okay. Oh, there you go.
Because Diesel is now powered by the blockchain because it's 2018 and that's how this works apparently.
I'm so sorry, Tess. I am so sorry.
No, so somebody actually, I don't even remember where this came about, but there was some news and it made me think, you know, I wonder if I put blockchain in the keywords of Diesel's cargo.toml, if like it'll start, if suddenly.
Trending.
Yeah, suddenly we'll start getting all sort of more downloads. Somebody was like, do it. And so then I went and committed it to the cargo.toml, and every commit gets a change log entry. So
people actually open pull requests like every month or every week. I get a new pull request of someone being like, can I change the name of the header? Or, and I'm not trying to make fun of them. Like they're so used to completely inflexible rules that they don't think, no, this is just a tool to get you to think in a sustainable way. Like, you're building software, it might not be for 15 years, it might be for a few months, but even then, I just build it and think. Someone was in a talk yesterday was like, oh yes, it was Mark saying, like, I knew that I wasn't supposed to be a hero and play hero and just try to do too many things at once. I knew, I had seen it in many companies I worked at, but I still, when I made my own company, I still did it because, just, you know, it's different. So you're like trying to follow those rules. Sometimes you just like, you're trying to match somebody else's expectations. If it doesn't match as yours, your project, or if it doesn't make any sense, you can remove some things that are never filled, like some headers that never have any entries.
I mean, I think maybe part of the reason for that is that a lot of the website reads like a specification.
Does it?
Parts of it do. And I think people are expecting it to be a specification.
Damn it. I failed. I tried. So the redesign was kind of like this. Like, it's a brochure. It's kind of like almost like it looks like a marketing website for a startup almost.
Yeah.
It's got a little nice little separated sections. I guess the only really prescriptive thing is the headings. It's more like, well, here's a set of headings. As an example, I think we're trying in a minor version upgrade. Try to changelog a thing that's for changelogs. It's impossible. Like, I don't know, when I add a translation, should I make a minor upgrade? Because we added Korean translation.
It should be a minor version. That's a new feature.
Oh, God, it's so much work, you know.
Patch versions are only for bug fixes.
Yeah, you're right. It's a new feature. Okay. Well, I should do that. But then the way that I interpreted Semver for that, even though I don't know if we say we follow Semver, but it was to say, well, the version of the recommendation hasn't changed. Like, there's no new recommendation. It's just, it's a different template. It's a Korean template. It's the same words.
Right.
Just available, I guess, in a way it's a feature. Yeah. So in the new version, I think I want to make it more suggest that, you know, you can adapt this. This is not a Bible. This is not 10 commandments. It's just...
Yeah, maybe something like, we recommend that you group your entries into headers. Here are some suggestions.
Exactly.
But these do not need to be the exact headers in your...
Precisely.
Was there ever a point where the website claimed that this was a machine-readable format?
People really, really want that. They really, really want to take a thing that is precisely made for humans and make it machine-readable. And I've never really cracked down and just, like, shut down all the pull requests of people saying, like, oh, I made a tool. I think it's awesome people make tools that they try to parse it. I know it's a pain to parse it. I know that people at gymnasium try to parse change logs. And it's useful for tools that try to show you just a portion, like a diff between versions and how many breaking changes happen, or for instance. I think we can figure it out with enough regex and coffee. But I don't care. This is for humans. So first, for humans, if machines can bend around the necessity to be human friendly, because we use sections that are, that's one of the reasons why the sections are organized. Oh, not the sections, the release title. So it's like version first, then date. So date dash version. It's basically version dash date. Yeah. And it's an ISO. It's like a database format date, or it could be a human readable date, whichever you think is more understandable. Because Americans like, and a lot of some people, like Brits and Americans, put like the month first, and that's super confusing for a lot of people, because like June 1st, or even if you flip it in the kind of like database style where you put, I hate this, like month/or month-day. I feel like I don't have stats, but I feel like no one, it's kind of like football, American football. No one else plays this game. Like, no one else calls this that. And you're like, you assume that everybody does because there's so much software coming out of the US. So anyway.
Touching a little bit on the machine readability, is like the last time we talked about this on the show, I mentioned, I was like, hey, I wish that there was a way for Gems to say, like, and here's where you find my changelog on Ruby Gems.
There is.
And then like a week later, you tweeted that you were like, hey, here's a new field that we have in Gems. And I was like, holy crap.
You have so much power.
But then I responded by saying, like, the next step is for Bundler to say, like, here's all your gems that, like, it already tells you when it updates a gem, right? I just want it to, like, put those at the bottom and say, like, this is what changed. And then, like, here's a link to the change logs for all the things if you want to see. And I don't need it to be machine readable. I'm happy to click them and read them with my eyes and interpret what they mean.
So you're either a divinity of some kind, or you just know what I'm thinking, like something. So I had a moment like that last month or 2 months ago where I tried to upgrade something on Bundler. It failed. Didn't tell me why. It just didn't update. And I was like, okay, well, the usual dance, you go to your gemfile lock and you look through and you're like, what requires this thing that I try to upgrade, and what is the lock? What is the version specification? That's the lowest common one, the one that's preventing my bundle update. And I was like, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. Why am I grepping a file? I'm a human being, damn it. So I just went through, I think I looked through Ruby Gems and I looked through GitHub to see, like, there's got to be a feature in Bundler. I just don't know because there's just so many cool features in Bundler I don't know. No, there's not a feature in Bundler. It's Bundler outdated. Mm-hmm. That's really cool. But there's nothing that can, so I think I yelled about it on Twitter, which is the way I get stuff done. And then Joe Masty said, hey, I have this thing called Bundler Stats. Yeah. That shows you, I think, how many things depend on a specific gem, or really interesting little stats about your gem file that works just like gem install that thing. Gem install bundler stats, bundler-stats, and you can do bundle stats. And it gives you those statistics, but it didn't have that one specific thing. But he already was using the Ruby Gems or the Bundler API internally in a way that was close to what I wanted. So all I had to do was just kind of like steal his code, rewrite it, make a pull request, and now you can install bundler stats. Tell it what gem is blocking, like, for which you want to upgrade and see what the lowest diff. So it's close to what you want, because what you want is basically a feature kind of like that that can tell you what has changed in this gem since I last used it, or just to any version in rubygems.org, or just in the tool itself.
I would want Bundler to just say, like, hey, you were running Rails 5.1. Now you're running Rails 5.0. Rails is probably a bad example because it's like 500 gems.
Right.
You were running Devise whatever, and now you're running Devise whatever plus one.
Mm-hmm.
Click here for your changelog if you'd like it.
And have that for every single gem that had its version changed with the non-blank changelog field?
Yeah. Yes, and at the bottom of the output, so that's what I see.
We could do this. I mean, you
could do it. I agree.
So you could complain about it on Twitter, and then somebody else could do it.
Yeah,
what's good is that now it's me saying it on your show, and now other people are going to be like, "Oh wow, I could, it is a good
feature of the podcast." I've had that happen a few times. Where I'm like, somebody should do X.
Yeah, you're drunk with power.
It happens.
Like, I want in Rails 6.
I mean, and if this makes it we were just talking with Eileen. I'm like, I'm mad at you because you gave a keynote, and now I have some things I want to do.
Yes, that's it. She has that power, like inspiration power.
But I guess we'll put a link in the show notes if this happens to get implemented before this goes out to the pull request.
No, I can't. I'm shutting down a website. I don't have time for this. I can't do this.
So you said, wait. You said you're shutting down a website.
Uh-huh.
Should we transition?
Before we get onto that, there's one more thing I think that I want to touch on. You can put change logs in your gem specs, in your gems, people who have gems.
Yeah.
You can link to the GitHub place where your changelog.md file is. If you're Caleb Thompson, you could link to your news.md file.
If you're anybody at Thoughtbot.
Exactly, yeah. If you work for Thoughtbot.
Very pedantic about these things.
The news kids on the block. You could do that, but what's cool is that, so first of all, gem specs and Ruby gems is super nice now because every time you push a different gem spec, it's a different thing. So this is super confusing. You can have a different change log for every time you push. So you can change something in your gem spec, and it will, just for that version, can link to a different file, which means that if you crop your change log or your README, you change your README in different, like, major versions, for instance, you can have one version using one README and or change log and one version using another. Mm. But we're just putting a link on rubygems.org. So there's a link to change log if you do add that little key in your gem spec. I think it's like metadata change log URI or something like that. But we could exploit it, right? We could just, now that it's available for the gems that have it, either Ruby Gems or it's more of a Ruby Gems feature, almost, I feel like.
Probably.
Yeah, we could totally do that. It'd be really, really cool. I think it would make Ruby Gems way more useful of a website because usually you just go to Ruby Gems, find the source, and look for stuff there because people don't maintain that over there. So anyway.
I need to add this to Cargo and Crates.io.
That's basically what I do, is like I say things and then he adds it to Rust magic. And then all the advantages we had disappear. And he's like, no, Rust is just, don't use that. Just use Rust.
So you're sunsetting a website.
I'm shooting him.
That might have been the most, like, I was just like, yeah, why?
Sunset.
So in your talk, you talked about how you don't like the term sunset because when a sun sets, it also then
rises. Comes back the next day. Like, that's unless something really, really bad happened, which it's not just your company shutting down or something like that. So it's not a company shutting down. We were acquired by Pluralsight, and for years and years, like 3 years, that's not that many years, we just did the same thing that we had been doing,
And now we're like combining everything, basically. We're going to have interactive courses, the same kind of like Code School interactive. You watch a video, you practice, you watch a video, you practice in a browser. And interactive projects and all the stuff that people loved from Code School. We're not going to transfer all of the things that were there. So there's some free, the one concern we have right now is like figuring out all the free stuff that we had. So like try Ruby, kind of a hairball, try Git, kind of complicated too. Like those are like kind of useful resources for a lot of the boot camps and schools even. Mm-hmm. So like I know that there's an open source alternative to try Ruby that was made by a developer, and it might be available on the Ruby website soon. Because there's a pull request to add it. Mm-hmm. And it's basically just like someone made a better Try Ruby that's open source. So that's cool. For Rails for Zombies, the problem is all of that content, many of these courses were really old. Mm-hmm. And so like we couldn't really just like transfer them and like build them in the new interface or in the new infrastructure at Pluralsight. So we thought, okay, what are the ones that make sense? And we just picked the like the most popular ones. I don't know the full finished list of courses that are going to be there, but there's probably going to be not that much Ruby stuff. Because sadly, most of that stuff was fairly old. So if you like to learn Ruby stuff, probably, or Rust stuff, I don't know, maybe you could become a Pluralsight author and actually make a course like that, or make a newer version for Rails 6 or something like that. That'd be really cool.
We always had that problem. So at ThoughtBot, we operate Upcase, which is like a subscription learning platform where we do courses. And we always had that problem with like, we put a lot of effort into like video content and that goes along with these lessons. Yep. And you can't just easily splice in an updated, here's an updated Rails version when the person's on screen talking about things.
Well, we had blue screen. So we use blue screen at Code School. Sometimes we cheated. We just took the keyed person and then replaced the slides behind them when they were showing like super deprecated Rails stuff. For instance, like I think we had Greg on Rails for Zombies. Like we redid it three times. One time was like sleeper. Just because like some methods we were using were completely wrong and breaking everything, but it was super hard.
Yeah. So it's hard to keep that updated.
I'm glad to see that my backbone workshop has finally been removed from Upcase. Or at least it doesn't show up on the page you can see when you're not logged in.
Yeah, it's been a hard thing to like, because in the right hands, that content, even if it was written for Rails 3.2, is still good.
Yeah, you're right.
But when you're in a position where you're like, I want to know how to write a Rails app, it doesn't help.
Especially beginners. Beginners are people who are just discovering Rails.
Right, it doesn't.
And the problem is, though, right, it might not even be that it's still good content. It might actually still be 100% accurate, depending on what specifically it hits. I mean, 3.2, almost certainly not, because everything has changed since then. But I would expect that any content written for Rails 5, unless it dealt with encrypted secrets, is probably going to continue to be correct for quite a while.
Even broader, like we have a test-driven development course, and like the idea of that is not to teach you a specific thing, it's to teach you a way of thinking. But still, people are like, this is outdated.
So are you saying we should put Semver on educational content?
No. Also, I'm just saying that once you start recording things in video, it becomes a lot harder to, like a blog post, you just go back and you update it and you edit it. But a video is a lot more expensive to keep up to date.
We also have infrastructure that we have this really awesome infrastructure that does eval as a service. remote execution as a service. Because we do interactive stuff, it's like in the browser.
Yep.
It almost boggles my mind, like how there's like we break down the abstract syntax of some code to just to find out if you're using not just the specific syntax, but something else. But those change all the time too. And it's really hard when you're evaluating code like that to evaluate the new version when you've never seen it. So the content will be correct, right? We'll teach you the right API, but maybe you'll try to use a new keyword argument or something like that, and we just can't handle it. So you'll have the right content, and then you try to go practice it in the browser, and it's like not working. Like we get support emails from people going like, "This is stupid. I tried this new feature, and you know, it seems compatible with Rails XYZ, and it's not working in your thing." So it's really hard. Also, not just video.
They don't understand that you're trying to safely execute the code that, like, actual code that they are writing in a browser, and you need to do things that are like perhaps gonna break when new versions of libraries ship.
Yep. And even if we consider it like the plague, like everything we do, it's like we basically put a container in space and send your code there. So if it blows up, like it'll just make a little gravitational wave or something like that when it blows up everything. But even then, it's just like it's not working for you. That's the thing that sucks. That's what's tricky. So there's a lot of stuff that's going to, I think sadly for me, you were talking about your Angular stuff, like deprecated old Angular stuff,
like
embarrassing old content that you made that is forever. I thought some of the videos would disappear of me wearing the worst haircuts and clothing and everything. So like testing with RSpec was the second, I think it's the second or first course that I did. And then there's a Git. Yeah, there's, oh, talk about puns. You ready? Git real. That was like my favorite titles that we came up with. Those were like really good content too, but like really old versions of Git and really horrible just dress choices that I made. And they're saving the videos because obviously that's useful for some people. So I can't even get the satisfaction of not seeing my terrible, you know, 25-year-old decisions. Some of those, I think the videos, many of them are going to try to archive on the Pluralsight website as a video course, just like they do, basically, mm-hmm. just like non-interactive video courses. So if like you needed that, I think anybody, I don't know what the details are going to be, but I think people who had a subscription or an account at Code School, there will be a way to access that somehow. So it'll be sad, but also if you needed it as a teacher, which is the thing that makes me the saddest, if you need it as a teacher, like there's tons of boot camps that just used, I didn't, that just use Code School as like the after school kind of like practice mm-hmm. thing. So yeah, there's hope there.
So how's the shutdown process been for you?
It was
emotional.
Yes. So like basically now it's the phase where I'm okay with it,
mm-hmm.
but there's a long phase where, you know, your team, you've built this thing from so many years. That is part of the talk. Like I think the video will come out, so you'll see me like just pour my soul out. But it was hard not to have a decision for a long time. Like you know that there's got to be something that either we power through it and we keep doing this thing like many acquired companies do, or you just decide to stop. But for a long time, we didn't really make a decision. We're like, we're going to keep trying for a while and see if it works. And it worked-ish. It worked okay. Mm-hmm. But it just didn't really make sense in the long term. So eventually, I think last year was when we made the decision. And so at that point, it was kind of like, oh, that was hard. Like when we made the decision, I couldn't tell anybody. Or like the people who were like relying on the educational content that we were still building, or like we want to tell them like, hey, download it, or I don't know, do something. Like we were always thinking of replacing it or doing something like that, but it's going to take time, so we couldn't really like announce it really right without having a replacement solution in mm-hmm. place. It was really hard. It was hard on the team. Lots of people, I mean, I'm sure that happens in lots of companies like that, but I never thought I'd have a job where I project myself like half decades and decades into it. So like early Code School days, you know, could do this for a long time. So it's kind of weird to see the thing that you worked so hard on. You train yourself not to be attached to your code, but like you look at it and you're like, ah, yeah, we built a bunch of really cool stuff in mm-hmm. there. And selfishly, I want to just open source it all. So like someone can learn from it.
Have you ever considered like maybe putting some of it on archive.org?
So the code, you mean? With just the website stuff?
I mean, like if it's not easy to just put the resources that you want and preserve directly, that wouldn't be moving over.
Sadly, they'll be less useful because of the interactive nature of it, because it's like
right.
it's executing
but,
stuff.
But you've still got something there. But then also, yeah I mean, is that a thing anybody's ever considered, this code that's just going to go away anyway,
yeah.
putting it up on archive.org? Because you can just upload the source code.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, you can
put more or less whatever you want up there.
Huh. I didn't know that. But what I wanted to do was like internal tools that we have, any kind of techniques that were cool that we used. The problem is it's not like we're just getting rid of it. So like
right.
Pluralsight's not going to be like, well,
yeah,
all
just
this
give
IP
all that
we
free.
Bought and we refactored into this other thing. They might. I don't know. They might. It's always funny with lawyers because like when it has no value to them, maybe they'll be like, I don't know if lawyers
no, the,
have looked
the lawyers will be no. This is our IP. We're,
yeah,
we might want to use this incredibly outdated content later.
Which is why I think we have a bunch of tools that are open source, like examples that actually were used for Keep a Change Logs early experimentation. Like Orientation is an internal documentation tool. It's kind of like a connected wiki. The idea is you connect to people who need the knowledge to the knowledge, so that when it changes, you know that it changed. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like the same kind of idea as Keep a Change Log. There's a bunch of actually team cohesion tools. That's just the worst word I could have used for that. There's a thing called Compliments that Katie Delphin built it's just a little thing that you could, it has a Slack integration. You can send a little public compliment to someone on your team or on your open source project and they receive it. It's stored. So like, I've talked to, I think Avdi about it too. Like we all, even the people that you think are the most accomplished people, we all have like a super soft spot for like people saying really nice things about us when we're feeling shitty. So that basically makes it public, which is weird and can have some weird side effects. But like these little things were things that we did at Code School, like to like make each other feel better, or like just take a minute to like tell each other, hey, you're awesome for these reasons. And just, yeah. That's an example. It's more like the culture.
We've started doing that at Thoughtbot with We use 15.5 for getting like weekly feedback. And one of the things 15.5 does is at the end of your weekly feedback, the idea of 15.5 being like you spend 5 minutes filling out this form and your manager spends 15 minutes reviewing them or something and giving you feedback or whatever. But at the bottom of every one of those is like, hey, you can give a high five to teammates.
Yes.
And so like those get recorded and then there's like a stream of them. But we've been trying to figure out like what to do to like one bit of feedback that we receive is like, hey, we need to celebrate wins more. Yeah. Than we do. And so like your idea of like, hey, what if we just had a screen in the kitchen
that just displayed these? It just flashed through. That wasn't my idea. It was Katie Delphin's idea and she just love her for that.
Katie's idea.
Yeah.
we have a thing internally at Shopify on a page we have called Vault, which is like just all of our internal stuff. A section of it's called Unicorns. And so just anytime anybody does something that you think is worth praise, we have a bunch of categories of like what specifically did they do that was above and beyond, but you can put as many people on it as you want. It pipes into a couple of channels, and then people come in and upvote them. And then there are achievements for achievement like being unlocked on a unicorn with three other people, or like being,
oh, that's
unicorn
cute.
That got
being
uploaded,
on a unicorn. Yeah.
Group praise. X number of times. It's the sort of thing like I could totally see this getting used if we were to like extract that part of it and just make it like a free service somewhere.
Yeah, definitely.
Because it's a neat idea.
So it's not the IP. It's not the code. That's the whole point of the talk was like it's the people.
Yep.
And so the people had these ideas. The ideas are good. They're free. You can use them. You're probably gonna build them your way like Shopify did. And in some ways, like one of the things I want to do is talk about some of the techniques that we use to do the course management stuff or the achievements or authorization stuff. And a lot of me is terrified that I'm just going to talk about it and people are going to be, this is stupid. Can is way better than this, or can is way better than this. Why didn't you just use that or rather than this thing that you did? And that's vulnerability, I guess. I should probably just lean into it. But we have, speaking of Katie Delphin, she made a thing we had a lot of badges and stuff like, celebrating your wins when you were learning. And eventually we decided, hey, we need participatory stuff. Like you've practiced a lot every day where you did a streak, kind of like Duolingo did. We had a Star Wars Day thing where you just showed up on Code School on Star Wars Day. Well, yeah, look at you busy working while everybody's at the theater, like something like that. And she made this thing called Badger. First of all, I can't remember who made the name. If it was a collaboration effort, I think it was a team effort, but it's an amazingly well-defined API where you basically set criteria. It's all Ruby, all beautiful, and you basically have criteria based on usage, presence. It hooks into device to see when you signed in and stuff like that. And you make a file that basically is a criteria, and when they match that criteria, we queue a job, we send them a thing. We're like, oh, good job, and they get a badge, and it's amazing. And I think that might be a thing I could sneak out of there.
Maybe I need badges at work.
We have to bleep you every time you say device, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he maintains clearance. So.
No, it's fine. Just use device.
I'm actually looking for alternatives because, like, do you have a GDPR compliance section?
We don't.
IPs?
We don't log IP addresses. We don't have feature.
You could set. That's literally the only sell you can do is, like, either force the device to update itself to, like, for trackable to be, like, GDPR compliant, like a little switch, or you say, well, just use clearance. GDPR compliant. I know.
We do have passwords, though. Is that a problem?
No. That's fine. You could just... I have another project that I don't maintain anymore called shields.io that makes little metadata badges. It's an open API. So you can literally go to img.shields.io/gdpr-compliant.png. I think there's a color also you can add there.
Okay.
And there you go. Get a little GDPR compliant badge.
I'm going to start putting that on all my projects.
That's amazing. Yeah. And it could be true or false. It doesn't matter.
I have some strong opinions about shields.io as a person responsible for operations of one of the repositories that it hits a lot.
Oh, what is that?
Crates.io.
Oh, man. Well, I don't maintain it anymore, so...
Oh, no, I know. I remember I was looking through because I got paged, actually, because they were hitting us so much that it actually started causing error rate spike to page me at, like, 2 in the morning.
Why would it be hitting you?
It's a direct interface between a lot of the package manager systems, so it basically you can put a badge. It'll do the job. It'll go check if the version has been updated to show the version, for example.
And they have no caching.
They do have caching.
It
as
doesn't
far as
seem
I know.
To work.
Well, they might have had a problem that day or something like that.
I mean, it's not going to cache
in general,
a bad
looking
response.
At having been watching the traffic, and I've been keeping a very specifically close eye on the rate of traffic that we get from them because it seems much higher than it ought to be, and it does not seem to, like,
Not
seem to work.
Hey, Sean, it's open source. You should open a pull request.
I know.
It's badges/shields on GitHub.
Oh, I know. So they were hitting this page that 404 and they hit it so many times it caused our 4xx response percentage to spike to the point where I got woken up at 3 a.m. And I went and looked, and it was this API endpoint. It was returning a 404, and they hit it 13,000 times. That sounds like five minutes.
Yeah, that sounds like a mistake.
Well, that's open source.
The thing is, I went and opened an issue. I'm just like, hey, I saw this thing, and they have absolutely no idea why or where it would have come from.
What's Node? So I'm not responsible.
Yeah.
At least I'm pretty sure it was them. I wasn't logging accept headers at that time, user agent headers at that time. But it was a IP address that is almost always associated with them.
It was the Russians. There's a Russian in the room. This is why this is funny. I'm not just mean to Russians. He's nice and smiley.
What else should we be asking you about? What are you excited about?
I mean, what am I excited about? I'm excited about, focusing on new stuff a little bit. Because, holding on to old stuff for a while. Loss aversion. I've been doing a lot of loss aversion. But, for instance, letting go of a project that you think is a super awesome idea, like Shields, and just letting other people run with it is super liberating. The problem is that people like Sean just give you shit for it. Every time something goes bad, you're sort of still responsible. Because I'm like, well, my idea was cool.
I don't blame you, for the record. The only reason I brought up was just I remembered when I went to go open the issue, I saw your face at the bottom of the README, and I just grinned a little bit. And I knew that you weren't personally responsible for it anymore. But I just that it made
it's
me
actually
chuckle
why
on the inside.
He was like, "We have to have Olivier on the show.
I'm gonna corner him, show him." No, I'm excited. What am I excited about? I think I'm post talk. I'm just a flight. Oh, I'm excited not to have a talk to give, and having. Oh yeah, I know I have another conference. So I'm. Oh yes, here's what I'm excited about: errors. So the talk I gave at RubyConf 2017 was human errors, and I don't know if it's plural. I made the talk. I can't remember if it's errors or error. Anyway, it was about making errors more human in Ruby. I think that it'd be awesome to do that more. Keyword errors or argument errors in Ruby are still not super cool. Lots of errors in Ruby are low hanging fruits that we can fix, and in Rails also. So. Yep. I think David talked about the barriers to entry in his keynote on Tuesday. And I think that's really important because there's lots of nice little community things we do to make it easy to onboard. But when there's an error is usually when people freak out and go, oh, this is way too hard or way too much. I know that just reading errors, because they look so scary, even if you flip the stack trace, they look scary. It doesn't really help there. Whereas, that's part of the talk. If you look at Elm errors, they look like just someone texting you, hey, man, I know things are not great right now, but here's some help.
And, you're probably getting this error because you forgot to pass one more argument, and it should have this type.
And you probably did.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
That's hard, but, we can at least bridge the gap between, huge stack trace, and then also the freezing a lot of those errors. Being an English major originally, it makes me sad that we are just saying things in the most mechanical, just matter-of-fact way. We could just phrase in a way that's less confused. That's one thing.
I think that there's a very specific reason that the phrasing is off on a lot of these.
Yeah, not just language-based. I think it's also programmers just thinking that the delivery doesn't matter.
Sure.
That as long as you get the information
or just
wrong.
Need wanting to not break a string across multiple lines.
Yes. But we have these amazing here docs now in Ruby 2.4 plus, the squiggly here doc. That's amazing. Way easier.
I did want to thank you for you made a change in Rails 5.2 for the logging of queries from views, because I've spent time where especially on large apps where it's there's a lot of queries happening here. And so I'm where are these all coming from? And my approach is generally I open up the template and I start commenting things out. And I'm do they still make that query?
Yep.
Nope. Okay, so it's coming from this template.
Same thing.
Then I just go. And so now just the ability to just be either turn, I don't know if it's on by default or whatever, but just
it was going to be even them. No, it is.
It's on by default in development.
Okay.
So it's on by default in development, not in the console, because that was kind of annoying. When you saw we had debugging on zero level, a debug, you would see the SQL query, the active record SQL query, and you would see the caller. So it's basically showing the call site if it works correctly. If it doesn't, please fix it or help me. But it should show you the call site from that initiated that query. So if you have a user.find something, you should see where that's called, which is super useful. Especially, that's a pro tip, I don't know what shell you use, but if you use iTerm, you can option click any call site, and it'll take you, if you have configured your editor and your shell properly, you can now, anytime you see an N plus one, you see the call site that originated one mm-hmm. of those queries or the N plus one queries, and just go option click the log, and you're in the file, and you're like,
if you're using a GUI editor.
Yes. Or you could just Vim whatever Emacs,
maybe.
You know, hook stuff up.
Sure.
So yeah, they would do that. Yeah.
Vim people were used to shelling things and stuff.
You can do it.
Cool. I think we should wrap up because we're running out of time here, but thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's fun having you.
Thank you.
Show notes for this episode can be found at Bike... no. I don't know the number, so...
You can just say at bikeshed.fm.
Yeah, I know, but I said... Yeah, okay.
You can say everything else the same. You just don't
do
put a slide.
This is, yeah, go ahead.
Show notes for this episode can be found at backshed. backshed.
We'll put them there, too.
Come on.
Olivier, thank you so much for coming on the Backshed.
Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you have feedback about any of our episodes, you can tweet us @_bikeshed, email us at hosts@bikeshed.fm, or leave a comment on the website.
Thanks for listening to the Backshed, and we'll see you next time.
And keep a change log.
Thanks for joining us, Olivier.
Thank you.
That was fun.
This podcast was brought to you by ThoughtBot. We are experienced designers and developers who turn your idea into the right product. With local studios in Boston, San Francisco, New York, London, Austin, and Raleigh, let's build something great together.